from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in Forum's opening hour this morning, in 2000, superstar lawyers Theodore Olson, a Republican, and David Boies, a Democrat, faced off in the bitter partisan battle known as Bush v. Gore. Later, they joined forces across ideological lines to take up a monumental challenge, the fight for marriage equality. Olson and Boies' new book, Redeeming the Dream, The Case for Marriage Equality, outlines their journey from 2008, when California voters passed Prop 8, to 2013, when its defeat in the Supreme Court allowed same-sex marriages to resume. They'll both join us in the studio. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Theodore Olson and David Boies, two of the nation's most preeminent lawyers, were nearly as unlikely as allies as Mary Madeline and James Carville. They were of different political parties and partisan political persuasions and were on opposing legal sides in the 2000 Bush-Gore presidential election. They joined forces to argue against Proposition 8, the California ballot measure passed by California voters in 2008, banning same-sex marriage. A year ago today, the United States Supreme Court invalidated DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, which had defined marriage since 1996 as being between a man and a woman, and let stand a lower court ruling that declared Proposition 8, outlawing same-sex marriage in California, unconstitutional. David Boies and Theodore Olson tell the story of the legal battle they waged for marriage equality in their co-authored book, Redeeming the Dream, and both Olson and Boies were named in 2010 to the Time magazine list of the 100 most influential people in the world. Theodore Olson is a former Solicitor General of the United States. He has argued over 60 cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, including Bush v. Gore and Citizens United v. Federal Election Commission. David Boies has litigated such high-profile cases as Westmoreland v. CBS, United States v. Microsoft, and Bush v. Gore. And we welcome both David Boies and Ted Olson to this morning's opening forum hour. Glad to have you both here.
Good to be here.
Let me, before we begin talking about the story, I may want to talk with you also about recent Supreme Court decisions. Let's talk about what brought you into this. I mean, you were both prescient enough to realize that this was a major civil rights battle, that this was like Brown versus the Board of Education for same-sex couples. But let's talk a little bit about the emotion side of this. I mean, Ted, you saw a lot of pain.
I did. Both David and I grew up in California. We went to public schools in California. I practiced law in California for 15 years. I think of California as a progressive state, a state of pioneers, a state of massive diversity all over the state in every possible way. It never dawned on me that Proposition 8, which would take away the rights of gay and lesbian citizens in California, would actually pass, especially at the same election where the people of California and all over the United States elected Barack Obama as president of the United States. And I could see the pain in the faces of our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters and coworkers and friends and neighbors. And I couldn't believe that this was happening. And when I was first contacted about the case, I thought that there is going to be a case that might ultimately wind up in the United States Supreme Court. And I'd like to be on the side of those injured individuals.
Didn't you talk to somebody, Chad Griffin, I believe, who was a Democrat? Rob Reiner set up a meeting with you?
Yes, Rob Reiner, the wonderful Rob Reiner and his wife Michelle, Chad Griffin, who's now head of the Human Rights Campaign, were talking about this issue. An ex-sister-in-law overheard them and said, you ought to think about calling Ted Olson. They thought this was a surprising suggestion, since I'm perceived as being such a conservative, but they thought, well, maybe that might work. And so I was contacted. To make a long story short, I came out to California. We had a meeting at Rob Reiner's home. Norman Lear was there. Other people that were supporting an effort to overturn Proposition 8, and we talked about it, and we bonded immediately over this case, and we decided we're going to do everything we possibly can to change the result.
David Boies, talk about what brought you into this case. I mean, you have California connections as well, but I mean on the personal level.
Well, on a personal level, I remember vividly 2004 when Gavin Newsom, who was then the mayor of San Francisco, opened up the county clerk's office to issue marriage licenses to people regardless of gender and regardless of sexual orientation. And I remember the television images of people from all over the country, all over the world, traveling to San Francisco, standing in line, trying to get one of those licenses. And I saw the joy and the happiness that was expressed by those people at the opportunity to get married. And before then, I had not really focused on the discrimination and the pain and the damage that was done by depriving gay and lesbian citizens of the right to marry the person that they loved. But on the television, I remember I was watching it with my wife, Mary, and I remember talking to her about what in the world are we doing as a country, as a society that believes in equality, depriving people of this right, and particularly doing it in a context in which it doesn't help anybody. And from that time on, I had wanted to do what I could to make marriage equality a reality. And when Ted called me about 5 years later and said that we had an opportunity to do this case, I jumped at it immediately.
Was it important to get an ally who had the kind of profile Ted just mentioned? I mean, GOP, conservative, even an icon to a great degree during the Bush administration?
I think it was important in a couple of respects. I mean, first, it was important to get somebody of Ted's ability and Ted's experience. Nobody has more experience arguing important high-profile cases in the United States Supreme Court than Ted has, and nobody does it better. So it was critical to get somebody who had that skill set and that level of ability and stature. The second thing I think was very important is to send a message that this was not a liberal or conservative issue. This was not a Republican or Democratic issue. This was a constitutional issue. This was a matter of civil rights, of human rights. And I think Ted's ability to talk to people on the other side of the aisle and the credibility that he had was very important, not only in dealing with conservatives or Republicans, but dealing with people in general. Because I think when people in general saw the two of us on the same side, it made them stop and listen and think about this issue. And this is an issue that if you can get people to stop and think about, 95% of the people are going to come out the same way. There's always going to be 5% that you never get. More than 5% of the American people still think the world is flat. But for 95% of the people, if you can get them to focus on an issue like this, where all the evidence, all the policy, all of the impulses and principles that make this country what it is are one way, then you can change people's minds. And I think having Ted and to some extent myself together helped do that.
Well, it was certainly a dynamic duo, and we got a bromance out of this as well, in fact. But Ted Olson, you got a lot of bad-mouthing, flack from fellow conservatives?
Well, yes. I think there were a lot of people that did not understand what a conservative was doing, advocating a recognition under the Constitution of the right of an individual to marry someone of the same sex. It seemed to me, however, that you have to take that sort of thing if you're going to adhere and fight for your principles. And I thought this was an opportunity to explain to people that marriage is a conservative value. The coming together of two people who love one another, who want to form an enduring, respected relationship, to be a part of the community, be a part of a neighborhood, to be a part of our economy, to raise a family. This is the American way, and that seems to me to be a quintessentially conservative value. And I wanted the opportunity to talk to conservatives, libertarians, to talk about how much marriage means. Marriage is taken for granted by heterosexual people an awful lot of the time because it is not a right that's been denied to them. In our conversations and our working with gay and lesbians in this country, we learned more, David and I and our wives learned more about our own marriages and what marriage means as a result of talking to people who've been denied that opportunity, to be denied that relationship, and to be denied that position in society. So this was an opportunity because, as David said, people would ask us, what are the two of you doing together? We wanted to take the partisanship out of this. We wanted to make it appear and make people understand that this was a bedrock American value, so that lawyers and individuals on the right and left of the political spectrum, whatever we thought about other things, we could have come together to agree about this. And so, yes, I got considerable blowback, and I'm still getting a little bit of that. But it's overwhelmingly overcompensated by the people that come up to us and say, you've helped us, you've fought for us. We're not the only ones. There are many, many people out there conducting these battles long before David and I got involved in this issue. But the fact that we joined into it had some meaning to lots of people.
Yeah, there was blowback with your book. In fact, Emily Brazelton in the Washington Post wrote, and I'm quoting now, Boies and Olson cast themselves as twin redeemers who saved same-sex marriage from the veteran lawyers in the field who had the temerity to disagree with them on strategy, never mind that it is the litigators whose handiwork has led judge after judge to strike down 14 state bans on gay marriage in less than a year, and 10 of those cases' appeals are pending, by the way. That fact is being steamrolled out of existence by Boies and Olson. David Boies?
Well, I think that there were a number of just plain factual errors in that review. I think it's too bad when people begin focusing on issues like who gets how much credit for doing what, as opposed to continuing to work for what our common goals are. This battle isn't over yet. There's a lot of work still to do. There's a lot of work to do to establish marriage equality. And beyond that, there's a lot to do to wipe out the vestiges of discrimination that continue.
You're still involved in the Virginia case.
We are.
And, in fact, Utah, Oklahoma, I mean, these cases may indeed wind up in the Supreme Court, any one of them.
One of them will, we think, and it might be the one from Virginia that Ted and I are handling, or it might be the one from Utah or Oklahoma. Nobody knows right now. But what we do know is whatever case gets there, everybody ought to be supportive of that. And, in fact, the people who are actually in the trenches, the people from Lambda, from Freedom to Marry, from the ACLU, other major organizations, have been working very closely with us and we very closely with them. There was some disagreement when we first brought this case. A lot of people thought we were moving too fast, too far. But very quickly, everybody coalesced and have been enormously supportive. And the blowback, the criticism that you get is basically from people who have never been in the arena. They're not people who have ever been plaintiffs. They're not people who have ever brought a case. They're not people who have been on the firing line. The people who are on the firing line have been enormously supportive, and we continue to work with them. We share moot courts with them. We share brief preparation. So there's a lot more cooperation than sometimes appears from the surface.
Well, your strategy was to go move full steam ahead, as it were, and it paid off, certainly. And there were other strategic things along the line. I mean, selecting the two couples that you selected, I mean, this was clearly premeditative and part of the plan. I mean, it was mapped out in your heads pretty much, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Yes. One of the things that's so important that we talked about at the very beginning with the Reiners and other individuals who were supporting this effort is someone was going to bring a lawsuit in California. Some couple were going to want to be married and were going to bring a lawsuit. That case potentially was going to wind up in the United States Supreme Court years later. My experience has taught me that how a case is presented in the United States Supreme Court doesn't just depend upon the briefs and arguments in the Supreme Court. It's what has happened earlier. What kind of foundation has been prepared for this case? What kind of evidence has been pulled together? Who are the plaintiffs? What court is the case brought in? We thought that every single detail of this case, if there was going to be one that would get to the Supreme Court, had to be done with meticulous and well-financed preparation. And so, among other things, we wanted to make sure that the plaintiffs in this case, who are going to be out there exposed to the public limelight and to harassment and telephone calls, hate mail perhaps, and a lot of pressure, had to be individuals who were stable, who were prepared for this, who were enduring relationships and who were going to stay together, and who had nothing in their background that would cause them to be embarrassed, that their families were going to be supportive. So we looked this over very, very carefully. And the four plaintiffs who were involved in this case, and Chris and Sandy and Jeff and Paul, turned out to be absolutely fabulous individuals. They presented their case. It was their case, not our case.
In fact, Chris Perry goes back to Schwarzenegger versus, or Perry versus Schwarzenegger.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was Chris Perry, Sandy Steer, Jeff Zarillo, and Paul Catani. Chris and Sandy, who live in Berkeley, they had been married after Gavin Newsom authorized marriages. They were joyful recipients of the beneficiary of his decision. They went and got married, and a short while later, when a court decided that Gavin Newsom didn't have the power to do that, they got a form letter in the mail saying, "Your marriage doesn't count. Your marriage doesn't exist." Can you imagine how deeply hurtful that would be? And they described this in the HBO documentary, The Case Against Eight, that aired earlier this week and is available now. That was just part of it. Those people were very essential to the case because the case was about them. It wasn't about me and David. It wasn't about a lot of other things. It was about individuals, human beings, that were victims of discrimination.
But David Boies, there was, and by the way, we're talking into Theodore Olson and David Boies, co-authors of a new book that is out there about their experiences fighting for same-sex marriage. It's called Redeeming the Dream, and that's a title that comes from Martin Luther King, actually. Theodore Olson is partner in Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher and is a partner at Gibson, Dunn and has argued over 60 high-profile cases in front of the Supreme Court. David Boies is chair of Boies, Schiller and Flexner LLP, and I'm just wondering about how important in this whole picture the Edie Windsor case was with respect to the Defense of Marriage Act that was argued by Roberta Kaplan. I mean, it was crucial, wasn't it?
I think it was a crucial case. The day that those two cases came down a year ago today, one of the things I said on the Supreme Court steps was that the decision in the Perry case meant that our clients could get married now, and the decision in the case in Windsor, the Windsor case, together with the district court's opinion in Perry, meant that soon people were going to be able to get married all across the country. The reasoning of the Windsor case is powerful. It's really very similar to the reasoning that the court used in the Lawrence case. Today is not only the one-year anniversary of Perry and Windsor, it's the 11th year anniversary of Lawrence against Texas. And Lawrence against Texas, 5-4 decision written by Justice Anthony Kennedy for the court, held for the first time that the federal Constitution protected gay and lesbian rights. And that case and the reasoning of that case really drove what happened in all of the litigation going forward. One of the interesting things is that Justice Scalia, in dissent in Lawrence, said, "This case means that there's going to be marriage equality." He didn't use the word marriage equality, but what he said was, "This case dismantles the constitutional structure that has prevented having state recognition of homosexual marriages." And he was exactly right. And we are all the beneficiaries of the Lawrence case and all the people that worked so hard to bring and win that case.
Can we talk just for a moment, though, if we may, about money? Because I mentioned Roberta Kaplan in the Windsor case, and she did that pro bono, and there has also been some criticism that your firms were involved, and I know they did. I saw the interview with Michael Signorelli. They had about 32,000 hours, roughly, and so much was done pro bono, but also over $6 million came your way, I mean, as a result of this defense that you put up.
Well, let me say, first of all, David and his firm did everything pro bono right from the very beginning. When we undertook this case on behalf of the plaintiffs in this case, I specifically felt that it was important to have a community effort involved in this thing. I knew it was going to be expensive. We were going to have to engage experts on various different issues that were pertinent to the rights of gay and lesbians to get married. We were going to have to take depositions. We were going to have a lot of expenses. I thought it was important for people to be involved other than lawyers. It's wonderful for lawyers to have pro bono cases, but it's very, very important for it to be bigger than that. And as a matter of fact, because we were able to raise money in the Bay Area, in Los Angeles, in the entertainment community, in New York, in the financial community, many people had a stake in this case. They felt that they were shareholders, that they were owners in this case. The financial community in New York, who helped us, also helped lobby the legislature in New York to change the laws of New York. At the end of the day, it was just my firm that had 32-plus thousand hours involved in the case. I don't even know how many thousands
that includes
of
all
hours.
The paralegal work and so
it
forth.
It includes
yeah.
all the partners in the firm, over 25 partners and associates, I think closer to 50 actually, paralegals, and other people that put in time on the case that we would normally have billed for. Three-fourths of the time that my firm put in on it was contributed to the case. So, yes, there were fees that were paid that amounted to about maybe one-fourth of the effort that we put in on it, but it was also extremely important that the people that were supporting the plaintiffs in many, many different ways, including the public relations efforts, because we wanted to communicate to the American public in every way we could that this was a fundamental value that the American public should support.
You had a whole public media campaign, really.
Absolutely. And we did it very seriously. We undertook from the very beginning because we wanted our plaintiffs to be accepted.
We're talking with David Boies and Theodore B. Olson about their book, Redeeming the Dream, The Case for Marriage Equality, and we're going to get you involved in this discussion. But I wanted to also say that you, I think graciously, in your book, you give some praise for the opposing counsel, Charles Cooper. But he really sort of opened the way for you. I mean, he messed up when he said, you know, I don't know what effect procreative purpose of opposite sex in marriage. I mean, that kind of took you steamrolled to the Supreme Court, really, didn't it?
Well, it really did, because when we started the case, we set out to prove three things. One, that marriage was a fundamental right. Two, that depriving gay and lesbian citizens of that right seriously harmed them and seriously harmed the children that they were raising. And third, that it didn't help anybody. And we easily proved the first. The other side really conceded that it was a fundamental right, and they just argued as to whether it ought to be extended to gay and lesbian citizens. The second, we proved through our expert witnesses and through the witnesses on the other side. And the third, that was when the judge asked Mr. Cooper, well, you're implying that there may be some harm to heterosexual marriage, allowing marriage equality. What could that be? And Mr. Cooper sort of danced around it because he's a good enough lawyer not to answer a difficult question if he can avoid it. And finally, the judge got a little cross and said, Mr. Cooper, you got to give me an answer. And he said, I don't know. Now, that wasn't a mistake. The fact is, there isn't any harm. And Cooper was an honest enough person not to try to make it up on the spot. And I think if he tried to make it up on the spot, that would have been caught too. So people look at that I don't know statement and they say, well, Cooper sort of opened the way for you. Well, he did in a sense. But what really opened the way for us is the facts, which is there isn't any harm. And what Cooper was doing was acknowledging that, as he almost had to, because, as I say, he couldn't come up with anything, and they tried.
It's important to note that the Utah case that was decided by an appeals court yesterday, the same thing happened. During the oral argument in that case, one of the judges on the Court of Appeals asked the lawyer defending the Utah statute, what harm would there be if individuals were allowed to marry someone of the same sex? Was that going to hurt heterosexual marriage? And he said, I don't know, because that's the answer. That's the truth.
Well, let me give out the phone number and invite listeners to join us. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In 2000, superstar lawyers Theodore Olson, a Republican, and David Boies, a Democrat, faced off In the bitter partisan battle known as Bush v. Gore, later they joined forces across ideological lines to take up a monumental challenge, the fight for marriage equality. Olson and Boyd's new book, Redeeming the Dream, The Case for Marriage Equality, outlines their journey from 2008 when California voters passed Prop 8 to 2013 when its defeat in the United States Supreme Court allowed same-sex marriage to resume. They're both with us in studio, and you can be with us as well. In fact, we welcome your involvement in the program. Again, you can join us at our toll-free number, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. We do welcome your phone calls. If you have some thoughts, questions, or comments, you can join us now at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org. Or post any questions or comments you might have onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQED Forum, or go to our Facebook page. And let's go to your calls. And we begin, David, with you. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. First, gentlemen, I want to thank you so very much for what you've done. I had the honor to be in a production of 8 last year, and I'm so grateful. 20 years ago, I couldn't get married. Last week, I had the opportunity to witness my mother and her wife get married after 35 years together, and it's shocking to me. But what I really wanted to ask is, do you think we have finally reached a tipping point? We're seeing almost weekly one state after another where the courts are saying, you're right, we've won. Do you think we finally have made it?
Are we there? Ted Olson, David Boyce?
I think we are. I think we have reached a tipping point. I think what you've seen in the last 12 months is you've seen 14 federal judges at the district court level appointed by 3 Republican presidents, 2 Democratic presidents, judges from all over the country, Texas, Oklahoma, Utah, Idaho, Oregon, Pennsylvania, all have decided the same way, uniformly. You can hardly get 14 federal judges to agree on anything. And here they all are agreeing that marriage equality is compelled by the federal Constitution. You had a Court of Appeals decision for the Federal Court of Appeals that includes Utah that affirmed the Utah decision just this week. I think the polls show that, unlike when we started this, where a substantial majority of American people opposed marriage equality, today a substantial majority of the American people support marriage equality.
Well, especially and among the young. I mean, it's disproportionate.
75 to 80% of all people under 30 support it. So we have reached a tipping point. Now, the thing to remember, though, is that we're not there yet. We've still, the war isn't over. And even when we've established marriage equality across the country in terms of the law, there's still going to be an effort to eradicate the vestiges of this kind of discrimination. You've seen from the governor of Texas and one of the senators from Texas just over the last week or 10 days, comments that reflect the old way of thinking, the discriminatory thinking. And this is not something that's just going to go away overnight. So I do think we've passed a tipping point. I do think that we're going to see marriage equality. I do think the country is changing. But we can't get complacent. There's still an awful lot more work to do.
I think, and you make this clear in your book, a major kind of watershed was Vaughn Walker's ruling. I mean, again, in terms of public education and awareness, I think you could almost compare it to the Scopes trial.
Well, the caller, David, worked on the play 8, which was written by Lance Black, who was on our board of directors, the American Foundation for Equal Rights, who helped support and finance the case and do other things. Lance is an Academy Award screenwriter, and he took the play, 8, and he took excerpts of the transcript of the trial, and he put it into – he took the trial of 8, of the Perry case, and put it into a play which has been distributed all over the world. Any theatrical group can put on that play. You can get actors together in one day, and they read their parts on stage. It opened on Broadway. It was performed in Los Angeles. But that was Vaughn Walker's genius that said, there's going to be a trial. We're going to have evidence on all of the issues that are pertinent to this. And it is reminiscent to the Scopes trial, except that it was more extensive. And then when he rendered his decision, after 6 months of deliberation, it was 134 pages long of detailed findings of fact and conclusions of law that laid out all of the issues in this case. It was a very dispositive and very influential opinion. Those 14 district court cases that David referred to a moment ago, each of them relies in part or in significant part on findings and conclusions reached by Judge Vaughn Walker.
How did you feel about going to trial? I mean, there's been some criticism that you were reluctant to go to trial.
Actually, we were not reluctant to go to trial. We thought we could win the case on, our opponents did too, on cross motions for summary judgment, put briefs in before the judge, and maybe affidavits about from various witnesses. Judge Walker, very early in the case, said, I'm a trial judge. There are factual issues here. And he said, how we do this is maybe more important than what we do, and I want to see a trial of all of these issues presented to me. As soon as he made that decision, we welcomed that decision. We put our resources together. We got help from the city attorney's office here in San Francisco, who have done a lot of this work, Dennis Herrera and Terry. Terry Stewart and others who helped us put all those witnesses together. Our opponents vigorously fought the whole idea. But we thought, this is a classic opportunity. And while our initial strategy was to do it on motions, as soon as the judge thought that a trial was appropriate, we embraced that.
Again, we're talking with Theodore Olson and David Boies about Redeeming the Dream, the case for marriage equality. And let me bring some more of your calls on. We go to Stephen next. Stephen, you're on.
Hi. I'm wondering, why do you think there are so many people who say they support equal rights, they support marriage equality, but when it comes to marriage equality for the polyamorous, they show the same bigotry and hatred as those who oppose same-sex marriage? And do you have any thoughts on how long it will take to achieve equality for the polygamous?
I think that's a very different question than the one that we've been addressing. And it's different for a couple of reasons. First, from a policy standpoint, there is a substantial body of work that shows that marriages that involve multiple spouses have serious issues with respect to the exploitation of women and what happens with the children. Now, people can debate those issues in good faith, but there's a substantial body of statistical, economic, sociological, psychological data and findings.
But David, forgive me, but there was also part of the argument from the other side. I mean, not necessarily from the Mormons who were supporting Proposition 8, but many of them said this is going to lead to multiple marriages. It's going to lead to acceptance of all kinds of things that, you know, people were afraid of, frankly.
But that's why I say that it's a really quite a different issue. And it's a different issue because there is a body of work that says that some of these other marriages, these other relationships, have serious secular problems, whereas there was no such evidence with respect to gay and lesbian marriages. The second thing is that from a legal standpoint, from a constitutional standpoint, what our fight was about was discriminating against gay and lesbian citizens, saying heterosexuals could get married, but gays and lesbian citizens couldn't get married. If everybody can have one spouse, there's no discrimination. You're not treating any citizen differently from any other citizen. Now, if you said whites can have multiple spouses, but African Americans can't, or gays can have multiple spouses, but heterosexuals can't, or as they say in India, Hindus can only have one spouse, but Muslims can have more than one, then in this country, that would be discriminatory. That would violate equal protection. But when you say to everybody you can only have one spouse, from a legal standpoint, that doesn't violate the Equal Protection Clause. So I think there are very significant differences. And I think the argument that was made against marriage equality, that this was somehow some kind of slippery slope that was going to lead to other kinds of required recognition of other relationships, simply didn't hold water.
And I'm going to go to some of your emails here. Pam, who is an elder at the Old First Presbyterian Church in San Francisco, writes, in the long ongoing movement toward wider acceptance of same-gender marriage, it's worth noting that the Presbyterian Church, United States, the largest Presbyterian denomination, voted last week to permit its clergy to officiate at legal same-sex, same-gender marriages, she says, without fear of prosecution in the church courts. Another listener writes, you guys are true American patriots in every sense of the word. My question is, did you ever think you were going to lose?
Well, we were certainly aware of the importance of the case, and you can never be sure what the court, particularly the Supreme Court, is going to do. But we looked at this very carefully. We looked at the decisions. I mentioned the Lawrence decision earlier. We looked at the Supreme Court jurisprudence. We looked at the facts. And we believe that this was a case that we could win. Now, we had several ways to win it. We could win it on standing. We could win it on a broad equal protection basis. We could win it on a narrow basis on the grounds that California couldn't take away a right that once it had granted it. So there were a number of ways that we could win. But we believe that in the final analysis, we would be able to restore marriage equality to California. And let me say also, I'm a member of the Presbyterian Church in Bedford, New York, and we were a leader in recognizing gay relationships even before the church as a whole did that.
Another listener writes, the problem with bringing suit is that Prop 8 is still in California's constitution. Support for same-sex marriage had been increasing in California, and likely Prop 8 would have been overturned at the ballot box by now.
Well, we don't know that. Public opinion has changed since we brought this suit in 2009. Public opinion has changed a great deal. We don't know, that may be attributable to the case itself, to Judge Walker's careful trial, his findings and conclusions. The opponents of Proposition 8 had just spent $40 million to defeat Proposition 8, and they had lost. Who knows what might have happened, whether they would have been able to raise that kind of funds again. The opposition spent even more money to defeat it. The opposition was very determined. There have been something like 30 consecutive state initiatives where the proponents of marriage equality had lost 30 straight times in a row. Who knows when that would have been over? Ultimately, we believed that the courts have to grant the rights of individual citizens the entitlement to marriage under the United States Constitution. It is, as someone you earlier mentioned, did you ever think that you were going to lose? We recognize that possibility, but we believe very, very strongly when you apply the principles that David discussed earlier, the fundamental right to marry, which has been recognized 14 or more times by the United States Supreme Court, and the illegality of discrimination against a class of citizens to that fundamental right, we felt that ultimately the Supreme Court had to agree with us, and that might mean freedom and recognition of equality for everyone in the United States. California might come out a different way the next time it was put to a vote. What about Mississippi? What about Arkansas?
Theodore Olson and David Boies are with us in studio, and by the way, they'll be appearing tonight at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco in conversation with Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom. That's 6 p.m. at the Fairmont Hotel in San Francisco. And let me bring another caller on here. And Josh, that's you. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I heard one of your guests mention earlier that marriage was a conservative value. I'd like him to elaborate on that and what that means socially and culturally for the court rulings. And also, just more in general, when are we going to accept that gender is A, spectrum, and B, a social construct, and how that will affect legal decisions in the future?
Well, Ted, you said that marriage is a conservative value. Of course, there were many, most recently controversial, one of our Bay Area's archbishops who went to a marriage, support marriage, and he's not talking about gay marriage. He's saying marriage is a conservative value, but he means it in an entirely different context.
Yes, and I should say that it's not just a conservative value, it is a liberal value. It is a fundamentally American value. It's a part of our institutions in this country. I said it was a conservative value because it involves liberty, association, privacy, when slaves were prohibited from getting married because the slave owner had to control the family and had to control the independence of persons who were slaves. When Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, slaves flocked to get married because it was a sign of their independence, their freedom. Suddenly, they were free to build families. Families are fundamental conservative values. Gay and lesbian people who have been in relationships of loving one another, who wish to come together to be a part of the community and form an enduring relationship, that is the bedrock conservative basis for this country. It's also, but what David and I were trying to convey was that it wasn't the property of conservatives or the domain of liberals. It was an American value, and that all Americans should be supportive of this relationship because stable families are a part of our country. With respect to the spectrum, we recognized right from the beginning that California's Proposition 8 limited the definition of marriage to a man and a woman. And we recognized right from the beginning there's a lot of debate and there's a lot of issues involved in who is a man, who is a woman, what the genetic and hormonal characteristics are and chemical characteristics. And there are many areas where there are ambiguities and differences there. Ultimately, that could be an issue in a similar type of case, because some individuals resist the being put in a box, man or woman. So there's a gender spectrum that's out there that could become very much a part of other issues involving discrimination between people on the basis of the their identity.
And let me go to more emails and website comments, and actually a question for each of you, but here's a listener who writes, you think that the way Prop 8 was worded on the ballot confused voters? I initially thought yes men in favor of marriage, and I was just saying to both gentlemen off the air that I think that was really a definite factor. It may have been, in fact, in terms of the way the votes went. Here's another listener who writes, I watched the case against 8, and the next night watched the special about the Northern students registering black voters in Mississippi in 1964 and saw so many similarities between the two sides in opposition to extending the rights one side possessed to those they saw as undeserving. Homophobic, racial prejudice, hatred, and prejudice were ultimately not allowed to rule the day. Thank you, Ted and David. Thank you to all of those who risked their lives in Mississippi. And we might add those who lost their lives in Mississippi, too. I'm thinking Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman, obviously.
And I might interrupt and say David was there in Mississippi doing civil rights work in those years.
I know, and let me just give David Boies, well, I'm giving you lots of props here, but David is actually endowed, I think, 9 chairs now, no less. You know, this is something that a lot of people don't know about you, is your philanthropic work. Another listener who says, what would have been the outcome had Jerry Brown and Kamala Harris chosen to defend the California Constitution and the will of the people of California?
Well, I think the outcome would have been the same. And the fact that Jerry Brown and now Attorney General Harris decided that Proposition 8 was constitutional was the right decision, but had the other side put on a vigorous defense. There could have been no more vigorous a defense. They could have participated. That would have given the standing under the Constitution for the Supreme Court to have to rule on the merits as opposed to simply approving Judge Walker's decision. But I'm convinced that the outcome would have been the same.
This is a little bit tangential, but I'm going to throw it your way anyway, Ted Olson. And then there's a question for David here. And I'm sure you hear this a good deal. Mr. Olson sounds like a very decent, caring person. How does he explain the logic and damage that Citizens United, which essentially allows unfettered campaign donations to be made to buy elections and policy be justified? Does he regret his role in arguing that corporations are people?
Well, corporations have been given constitutional rights for over a century. Let's say, for example, the New York Times, which is a corporation, it has constitutional rights. It advocates the election defeat of politicians and supports or opposes political issues all of the time. The supporters who filed briefs in supporting this small corporation, Citizens United, was a tiny corporation, had 1% of its funding from corporations. It wanted to make a movie about whether or not Hillary Clinton should be president of the United States, like Michael Moore makes movies that have political themes. corporations have to have constitutional rights or else the Internal Revenue Service could go in and invade your home. We were supported in that case by the ACLU, by major labor unions, by the Sierra Club, and on the other side of the political spectrum by the gun groups and so forth. So, and Floyd Abrams, who's probably the preeminent First Amendment lawyer in the United States, was also supportive of us. The issue in that case wasn't unlimited spending. It was whether or not corporations, because of the nature of their formation, could advocate or oppose political issues. Corporations have interests because their financial and their stockholders' interests come together with respect to some of these issues. Let's say environmental laws or trade regulation or things like that. That impacts the corporation and the people they represent. So, no, I don't think I was wrong. I'd like to spend more time talking about
Well, I'll tell you what. We'll have you back because it keeps coming up, and mostly we hear from the other side. So at least I heard your defense there.
You've just seen why it was so important for me to have Ted on the side.
Yeah, exactly.
Because anybody who can make a plausible argument in favor of Citizens United is a really great lawyer.
There's brilliant. But let me get to a couple of other things that you said, David, that some getting some response back on. Here's a listener who says, if it is true, this is kind of a comment and then a question that's ancillary to that or actually coeval with it. Rita writes, if it's true that 95% of people can be convinced that marriage is a constitutional right, what does that say about Scalia and his fellow justices? Talk about outliers. Here is another listener who says, I think it's a bit naive for David Boies to say 95% of people will agree once you make the case for civil rights. People who believe in the Bible and the Quran as the word of God will not be swayed by the argument. And that's a pretty large amount of people. I believe every shred of opposition to gay marriage derives from religious beliefs. And then just let me add one more email from Regina, who says, marriage is a blessing for a man and a woman to lovingly procreate as a one unity. Men do not procreate with other men, and women do not procreate with other women. It just is not suitable for gay couples to be married. So there you get the whole argument against 95%, I guess.
Sure, but remember, we've already got essentially 80% of people who are under 30. Now, all I have to do is get another 15%. And I think 80% is actually pretty good. And you're going to get that as people of my age pass on because we have a demographic wave coming. And that demographic wave have grown up knowing a lot of people who they knew were gays and lesbians and who they knew were their brothers, their sisters, sometimes their children, their parents, their uncles, their aunts, their teachers, their clients, their lawyers, their doctors. Those people know the essential equality of everyone, regardless of sexual orientation. And that's what it takes. The reason that people of my age find that difficult is because we grew up in a different era. We grew up in an era in which we didn't know a lot of openly gay and lesbian people because the discrimination was so brutal in those years that a lot of people felt they had to conceal their sexual orientation. As those days have passed, what has happened is that more and more people have grown up seeing openly gay and lesbian citizens, and they know that they deserve all the equal rights that everybody else has. So if you look at the young people, that's the future of this country. And is 95% a aggressive goal? It is. But we're already at 80% with the young people, and I think we can get to 95%. Just as I think you've got about 90-95% of people today who at least will say they believe in racial equality.
A lot of fundamentalist believers, though, both on the Christian and Muslim side, still in this country. I was just talking the other day to a friend of mine who happens to be British who was saying, boy, you guys got more religious devotees in your country by a far stretch than we have in England. And it's true. And then most of Europe, which become much more secularized.
A lot of people came to this country because of their right.
Their religious freedom, exactly. Let me just read another comment here on our website from a listener who writes, thanks to Olson and Boies, my partner of 30 years and I were able to marry in California 2 weeks ago. It has solved many uncertainties in our lives. One of us lives for much of the year in Minnesota. As a result of the Prop 8 and DOMA decisions of the Supreme Court, the Minnesota legislature also legalized same-sex marriage in Minnesota. This made it possible for our marriage to be legal in both states. Talk a bit, if you would, because this is part of the ongoing battle about how this is going to play out in terms of states that allow it and states that don't allow it.
And it's so touching to hear those stories. And David and I were at a book signing event last night in the gay and lesbian community, and we heard story after story after story of people that have been together for 5, 10, 15, 20, 43 years, one couple, who finally were allowed to get married. It's so gratifying and inspiring to hear those kind of events, and it's all joy. I mean, it's not uniform in everybody's life that marriage is perfect or will always be perfect, but the opportunity for people to come together and have that same relationship as other people is so important and so gratifying. And it is the movement that's spreading throughout the United States. The case,
but still not uniform in every state. That's
no,
my
it
point.
Isn't.
So
and
yes, got that fight ahead.
Yes, but many, many, many people, a large proportion of the United States live in states where it is permissible now. Marriage equality is recognized. There are other cases that have been stayed where courts have struck down opposition to marriage equality, waiting for a Supreme Court decision. And there are cases where in many states, the legislature or the people have changed, like Minnesota, like New York, like Maryland, like the District of Columbia and so forth. So there is a tide coming that's changing this. I think, and David feels too, that it will not be long before marriage equality is a uniform law throughout the United States, and your marriage in California will be recognized in Arizona or Mississippi or Arkansas.
And can I also get you both on record just to counter some of the criticism that's come your way, that you would both strongly concede that there were many fighting in the trenches over 30 years for these rights?
Absolutely. And we said right from the beginning, Robbie, you mentioned Roberta
Kaplan.
Yeah. We worked together. She argued the DOMA case. We argued the Proposition 8 case. We worked our preparation sessions together. There were people from the ACLU there. There were people from Lambda. We all have to come together. And we, David and I, recognized right from the beginning that many pioneers built building block after building block that we were standing on top of or they were providing us help. We read those briefs. We listened to them. We read the things that they had written. It's important that everyone come together.
And you can come together at the Commonwealth Club tonight in conversation with Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom at 6 o'clock. David Boyce and Ted Olson. Quick remark from you, David.
What I say, in our book, one of the things we do is we recognize how important the work of other people has been and how many, many other people were involved in this work and made tremendous contributions that we built on at a time when it was not as easy as it was for us. And some of the people did things that were unpopular, that were dangerous, and we have the highest, just the highest respect.
Go back to the Madison Society, go back to Stonewall.
We mentioned all that in the book.
Thank you so much for being with us. Congratulations again on your victory and onward.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.